Good morning all, and welcome to the Weber Training Teleclass, Sanitation and Hygiene in Food Processing. My name is Paul Weber, and I'd like to thank you all for joining me on this teleclass today. I dare say this is the first teleclass experience for many of you. I hope it won't be the last. This teleclass is being sponsored by the Ontario chapter of the Canadian Sanitation Supply Association. The board of directors of that organization requested this topic for their members, and we have been working together to make it happen. My thanks to them for their support and their faith in teleclass education. Our faculty today is Dr. Keith Warner. Dr. Warner is a food microbiology specialist and professor in the food sciences division at the University of Guelph. His academic work has included the development of UV lasers for package sterilization, DNA fingerprinting to identify points of cross-contamination in pork processing, and particularly the interaction of human pathogens with salads and table vegetables. So to bring us the teleclass, Sanitation and Hygiene in Food Processing, from the University of Guelph, it is my honor to present Dr. Keith Warner. Keith.
Okay, thank you, Paul, and hello, everybody. My name is Keith Warner from the Department of Food Science here at the University of Guelph, and today I'll be talking about sanitation and hygiene in food processing. What I'll be doing is giving an overview of the importance of sanitation, some of the regulations, federal, provincial, and municipal, that relate to sanitation standards. I'll be going in depth about sanitation plans, what they mean, how to develop them, how to monitor them. I'll be giving a brief overview of sanitizers that are available. It's not going to be an extensive list, but the key ones. I'll also be covering sources of contamination. And in this section, I will be including a brief overview of molecular epidemiology, which can be used to identify or pinpoint sources of contamination, which obviously is a help to identify how to address them. And finally, I'll be giving my opinion on future directions. Next slide. Obviously, sanitation has come a long way from the early days of food manufacturing, where it wasn't on the top priority. Next slide. But obviously, what has happened, especially in the last century and the last part of the 19th century, was the focus on sanitation. And it must be emphasized that the greatest benefit to public health has been through focusing on sanitation, increasing standards. Next slide. As you all know, sanitation is a part of a prerequisite program of hazard analysis of critical control points. And although people say a lot about HACCP in terms of how it's reduced the prevalence of foodborne illness since its introduction in 95, if you actually look closely at the details, it's actually sanitation or increased sanitation or more effective sanitation that has actually been mostly responsible for reducing the prevalence of pathogens and hence reduction in foodborne illness cases. Next slide. When we talk about sanitation, we're not only really concerned about the contact surfaces, i.e. the equipment, but also the food processing environment. And more from that, we're also interested in airborne contamination, the quality of air. But more significantly, perhaps, it's the quality of water, because obviously water's direct contact with the environment, the contact surfaces, and even including the product. Next slide. So we all know sanitation is important, but it's always good to re-emphasize that the major foodborne illness outbreaks that have occurred have usually implicated poor sanitation. As an example, we can go to the Bilmar Foods outbreak in 98, which implicated frankfurters contaminated with Listeria monocytogenes. Listeria is a psychotrophic human pathogen, which basically means it can grow at low temperatures. And as you can understand, by being able to grow at low temperatures, it can become endemic within processing plants, especially dairies. And although you don't see Listeria on the headlines very often, it is a very virulent pathogen. If you actually contract Listeriosis, the chances are, one in three chances, that it could be fatal. And this was what was found with the Bilmar Foods outbreak. There was 80 cases and 21 deaths. And although that's important, the actual recall was 17 million kilograms of product, which resulted in a direct loss of $76 million. Obviously, this had a dent on consumer confidence and a loss of further $200 million through lost sales. And even after those losses, the actual litigation which followed the outbreak cost $5 million, which by today's standards is they got off fairly lightly. But there again, the cost is there. Next slide. Another outbreak directly linked to poor sanitation was the Pilgrim's Pride outbreak in 2002. This was associated with deli meats, again listeria. You'll notice that comes up frequently in terms of sanitation due to the reasons I've just given. And that one resulted in 14 million kilograms of product being recalled, 46 cases of listeriosis and 10 deaths, and the estimated loss was over $100 million. Next slide. A more recent outbreak in the UK, Wales specifically, involved a butcher, John Tudors and Sons, and they produced deli meats for the local schools there. And what happened here was a cross-contamination between raw product and cooked product. And the pathogen implicated in this case was E. coli 0157. And that resulted in over 150 cases of E. coli. Although this doesn't sound a lot, if you followed the story, there was a lot of sad cases, and actually one poor boy died from that. And as a result, there's been a major review of food safety standards within the UK, and one can expect litigation and regulations impending after that. Next slide. So just to underline the importance of sanitation, through a CDC survey in the USA, 35% of all the foodborne illness cases could be attributed to poor sanitation. The main problem is personal hygiene, things like hand washing, and also obviously the environment, contaminated equipment and the environment itself. So through all that, to sum up, sanitation is very important. Next slide. Because of the importance of sanitation, a lot of the food safety regulations specifically focus on sanitary practices. And in terms of regulations, it's important to understand there's different regulations depending on the level. So you can have federal regulations, provincial and municipal. In terms of federal regulations, the agencies involved are the CFAA, which are basically the enforcers, the inspectors, and the policy divisions are Health Canada, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. So they have responsibility for developing guidelines, policy for the different food sectors, and the CFAA, if you like, are the ones that implement those guidelines. Next slide. In terms of food safety policies, there's a lot of legislation around food safety. I've left a link on there if you want to read them in detail, but the main one is the Food and Drug Act regulations, which we'll come on to later. Next slide. In terms of provincial inspection agencies, the three main ones within Ontario are OMAFRA, the Ministry of Health, which basically investigates cases of foodborne illness, and the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources. Now, it must be remembered that the actual regulations on a provincial scale differ from those of a federal scale. The federal agencies focus on cross-province exports and also international exports and international issues. Within province, the regulations slightly differ, but there are moves to try and harmonise these in order to get a level playing field across Canada. Next slide. In addition to the provincial and federal regulations, there's also municipal level regulation as well. And these really, as you can imagine, focus on local issues. So, for example, water quality, waste emissions, etc. And also they focus on food service establishments and retail stores. Again, the regulations at the municipal level can differ from those of the provincial level. So it's always good to make note of that when you're actually developing any sanitation plans. Next slide. In terms of regulations, as I was pointing out, the Food and Drugs Act of 1985 is the main regulation in the food industry. Although you might think it's a fairly comprehensive document, in actual fact it's not. It's fairly short. And Section 7 really focuses on sanitation. All it says is that no person shall manufacture, prepare, preserve, or package or store food for sale under unsanitary conditions. Now, the point is, that's all it does say. It doesn't tell you how to achieve this goal. So what they have done also is published the code of practice, which is on the next slide. So the code of practice, or the code as it's referred to in the industry, is essentially a list of guidelines in order to meet the requirements of the Food and Drugs Act. Now, it's based on Codex and the SPS standards, which are basically international standards, and so it's more like a global standard, if you wish. Again, if you want to actually read more about those, I've left a link on the slide so you can actually read it in depth. Next slide. In terms of sanitation, the code of practice focuses on all aspects of food processing and production. So essentially it covers the sanitary facilities, the air quality, the water quality, the construction, the sanitation procedures that should be employed, hygiene and health requirements, and also focused on training, which we'll see is important later on. Next slide. So in terms of a facility, things like drains are important because they're a source of listeria and other contamination. And so what the code does is tell you what design, the number of drains you should have, and also how to prevent pools of water developing, because pools of water are very good breeding grounds for pathogens such as listeria. In terms of construction of walls, obviously easy to clean and non-absorbent is the key. And contact surfaces, again, non-absorbent, free from pitting crevices and capable to withstand repeated cleaning. As we'll see later, crevices pitting are very significant when we talk about the effectiveness of the sanitation. Next slide. Coal stores obviously are a breeding ground for pathogens like listeria, again, because the listeria can grow under cold conditions. And so it's very important to actually modify the relative humidity and also ensure adequate airflow, because if any two of these aren't controlled, then the chances are that listeria can proliferate, become endemic, and therefore hard to get rid of, and it will contaminate the product subsequently. Next slide. The code also refers to a sanitation program, which is very important. So a sanitation program is an effective program for equipment and premises in place, as in you have a list of requirements that a sanitation should have and it should be implemented. Now, to aid this, there's something called a sanitation standard operating procedure, which is essentially a document which documents specific sanitation procedures at each point of the processing facility or area. So this is fairly extensive documentation, but what it's in a sense saying is that for each point in the plant or each area, you have to have a standard sanitation operation plan. Next slide. So SSOP plans, the key point is they provide a schedule for sanitation procedures. So essentially it tells when you're going to actually do the sanitation and who should do it. It also provides a support for routine monitoring. So obviously it's not just enough to actually undertake the plan, but it's also important to actually monitor that it's been done consistently and effectively. And by having documentation, you also encourage prior planning in order to enable corrective actions to be in place. So what we're saying here is that by learning from mistakes, as in mistakes that happen, you know how to correct those mistakes instantly rather than running around thinking what to do. So corrective action plans are important. And also by documentation, you can identify trends to prevent reoccurring problems. So if you notice that microbial counts, when you're verifying the sanitation program, are increasing, you know you have to change something. So it's very good for trend analysis. Next slide. Now, it's very important when developing SSOPs is to make sure that everyone's involved. And by documenting sanitation programs, it gives an opportunity for everyone to be involved, from the management right through to the production workers. And it gives a greater emphasis of understanding the importance of sanitation. An important thing about documentation as well, it provides consistent training tool. Typically what would happen in previous years is someone entering a sanitation crew would be just taught by the person who's done it before. And obviously the training can get a bit blurred through time. So by having standard procedures for training, it's more consistent. So regardless of staff turnover, the actual sanitation plan will be consistent. And obviously by documentation, you also lead to improved sanitation practices because it evolves. Like hazard plans evolve to be more effective, so can sanitation plans evolve. If you want to read more about how to develop SOPs, etc., I've left a link on there as well on the slide, and you can find much more detail about it. Next slide. Obviously, once you've done the sanitation plan, there must be a way to actually verify or see how it's performing. So you have what we call sanitation performance standards. Now, these standards are essentially based on the food code. As I mentioned, the food code has a long list of what construction should be done, what sanitation practices should be done. So you can use this list to actually assess how effective the sanitation performance is. And so essentially these address the conditions within the facility itself. So for example, inspecting the construction, inspecting how sanitation is performed. So if you like, the sanitation performance standards are used in combination with SOPs in order to get an effective sanitation plan. Next slide. Obviously, when you're performing sanitation, there must be a way of monitoring it because you can't rely on people to follow plans as you want to. They'll always find shortcuts. So by having a sanitation monitoring program, it gives you more consistency. And this is actually written in the code, as I've written down there. So basically, what it's saying is that you've written the plan. By monitoring that plan, you're just verifying, if you like, or confirming that it's been undertaken in accordance with the plan. Next slide. Sanitation testing, obviously, is very important to know how effective the sanitation has been. And there's two elements to this. There is the monitoring element, which is on-site in real time, if you like. And essentially what those elements are is just ensuring by observation that the actual sanitation plan is going according to what has been written. So we're talking about sanitizer concentration, contact times. Now, verification is different because verification is more long-term, and verification is essentially saying the sanitation plan is working. So if you like, monitoring is assuring that the plan is being implemented, and verification is just confirming that it's an effective plan. And so you'll find things like microbial testing comes into play here. Microbial testing takes at least 48 hours sometimes to confirm, so you can't use it to real-time assessment of the effectiveness of sanitation. It's just there for verifying that it's effective. Next slide. The importance of sanitation is really so it gives a culture throughout the actual processing line or even the industry that things are actually being done. As I was mentioning, if you don't monitor the situation, it's likely that people deviate more from the actual plan itself. So it's very important to actually have a monitoring system in place. Next slide. So in terms of sanitation monitoring forms, they don't have to be very extensive because obviously documentation is always a bit of a drag in many cases, but the bare minimum it has to have is it must specify the sanitation conditions or practices to be monitored. So, for example, are they using the right sanitizer? Are they using the right detergent? Are they doing the correct steps? And you must leave space within this form to actually record observations and prescribe frequency. So you must be able to confirm that it's being done, and you must obviously note down that it's being done with the right frequency, as in terms of it hasn't been left for 2 days when it should be done every day. And very importantly, as I was mentioning, is that it's an evolving process developing a sanitation program, so there must be a space necessary for corrective action. So when something goes wrong, you must list down how it was corrected, because this enables the plan to develop and therefore get more effective. Next slide. In terms of what you monitor, as I was mentioning previously, you know, the type of detergent, the concentration used, the contact time. Obviously, this is important because if you have excess sanitizer, although people always say more is better, in reality, it can be detrimental because it can cause corrosion. And obviously, it wastes a lot of money as well. However, if you have too low sanitizer concentration, there's a chance of developing resistant mutants because bacteria, if it doesn't kill them, it literally does make them stronger. So you have to be fairly wary of using the correct concentration. Next slide. Monitoring has to be done in real time. haven't got too long, but obviously, most of it's done by visual inspection. So you visually look at surfaces, you look at how the sanitation is being performed. But there are rapid test kits out there. The rapid test kit, for example, is based on protein residue testing. Obviously, if you find protein residues, it means that the sanitation hasn't been totally effective. My own experience with these is a bit dubious, as in I don't think they're sensitive enough. So more commonly used is what we call ATP bioluminescence assays. ATP is, if you like, the energy currency of a cell. A live cell has a lot of ATP, dead cells have no ATP. And so what you can do is you can get a swab sample from the surface, you mix it with some reagents, a light-emitting enzyme in this case, and then you read it using one of these devices shown in the pictures. So it's a very rapid test, it's over in 5 minutes, and it gives you an indirect measurement to see if there's actual microbial contamination still on the surface. BioTrace and BioControl are two systems that are more available commercially. Next slide. Now we come to verification. As I mentioned, this isn't real time as such. This is just ensuring that the sanitation plan is adequate. You can use ATP again, but this has to be with low risk areas. So for example, you would not use an ATP test to verify the effectiveness of sanitation in a ready-to-eat end process operation. More common what people use is microbial swab samples. So these can be swabs using cotton buds. It can be contact plates or Rodac plates, as they're called. Or you can have sticky tape, which basically lifts off the contamination from the surface you're analysing. And from these samples, you can actually enumerate the total aerobic count, which is basically a measure of how much contamination is on the surface. You can have specific or selective plates to look at spoilage microflora. So, for example, Pseudomonas is a spoilage bacterium, so you might be interested in the levels of that. Or more commonly, you would look for fecal indicators, i.e. these are bacteria that indicate the presence of fecal contamination. And typical indicators are Enterobacteriaceae, coliforms, or generic E. coli. Next slide. Now, obviously, once you get the results back from the microbial testing, you want to know, well, is that within limits or is it out of limits? And it might have come as a surprise to know, but there's actually no specific criteria that suggests that a sanitation program is within compliance or out of compliance. So what you tend to do is do what we call a trend analysis, as in, is the numbers of the microflora on contact surfaces increasing? That might indicate a resistant population emerging. Or is it decreasing, as in the sanitation program is working effectively? However, saying that, there are certain criteria people have developed. These are more like from stakeholder groups, etc. It's not under regulation, which, for example, for the ATP test will say within 0 to 5,000 counts per second. That's an acceptable measurement and says you are in compliance. Another example is in meat processing lines, where it's deemed that total aerobic counts of less than 10 CFU per centimetre or Enterobacteriaceae counts less than 1 CFU per centimetre are within compliance as well. But it must be noted there's no scientific basis that suggests that this is an adequate criteria to assess surfaces. It's what people have developed from previous history. New slide. So in terms of sanitation control procedures, as I was mentioning, is that sanitation, if you like, is a prerequisite program in the hazard analysis of critical control points. So under a normal program, you would assume sanitation and good manufacturing practices are in place, as in you don't need to worry about those. You only focus on what we call critical control points. However, because of the importance of sanitation, there is actually what we call SCPs that can be integrated into the HACCP plan. So what this is a bit like the critical control points, except that they're based on sanitation. Next slide. Just to illustrate that, for example, in a HACCP plan for a fish smoking operation, a critical control point would be an intervention that reduces or eliminates potential hazards. And obviously, in that process, the actual time and temperature used for smoking the fish would be critical. Because if it's not high enough or long enough, then you're going to have pathogens surviving. So that's what we call a critical control point, or a CCP. In terms of sanitation or SCP, it can be viewed that, for example, without washing hands, you might cross-contaminate the products, so therefore that's a SCP, a very critical point, and also cleaning of surfaces, etc. Again, that can be viewed as a critical point within the process, but it's not a critical control point, it's a sanitation control point. Next slide. Now, with any sort of plan, it can't be overemphasized enough, is that training really is the key to successful sanitation. You can have documentation, monitoring methods, but without adequate training, it's going to be not as effective. And it's interesting to note that some of the major sanitation suppliers, sanitizer suppliers, actually incorporate a degree, some training for food handlers, etc., or food workers, in order that they use their product correctly. And that's a growing trend within the industry. So when you talk about training, it's very important to get away from the old methods where you essentially give someone a manual, ask them to read it for 30 minutes and start work. What you have to do really is motivate them, and it's important, and you motivate them by getting them involved in every sort of aspect. Certainly the training should be focused and practical, and also records should be taken, as in training records are very important because it gives a motivation to do more training. And incentives, obviously incentives usually mean money, but it's well worth the money, as you can see from the previous examples, what happens when you do have foodborne illness outbreaks linked to poor sanitation. But it's very important to get all the staff involved in not only developing the plan, but implementing it, monitoring and verifying it, so they're responsible for taking the samples, etc. Next slide. Now, it might come as a surprise, but in terms of sanitation, not everyone appreciates that there's 5 steps to sanitation. From my personal view of looking at some sanitation processes or steps currently in the industry, they fail to follow the 5 steps, and this has put them in hot water when they've had to face lawsuits. So the 5 steps of sanitation are critical. When we talk about the 5 steps of sanitation and cleaning, the first step is dry cleaning, which basically removes the large debris. They have then a pre-rinse to remove the small debris or fine debris. Then you apply the detergent to get rid of the organic matter. And then you have a post-rinse to remove the detergent and organic matter. And then the final 5th step is the final sanitation step. Next slide. When you're actually doing the first step, that's the dry cleaning, it's very important to use the right tool for the right job. In this terms, it's brushes, for example, must be the proper stiffness. Now, it might seem a bit unlikely that the stiffness of the brush would impact on the sanitation efficacy, but the fact is, if you use 2 abrasive brushes and you make crevices or cracks or pits in the contact surface, this forms a nucleation site, if you like, for the formation of what we call biofilms, which I'll refer to later. So anything that causes cracks or pits should be avoided. In addition, it's also important to, if you use pressure sprays, is to avoid using high pressure, because high pressure sprays actually redistribute contamination rather than actually remove it. So it's very important to use moderate pressure, and obviously moderate pressure also saves wear and tear on equipment. Next slide. Another factor that should be aware of when you're talking about the equipment used for sanitation, such as brushes and pads, is that they should have specific brushes for specific locations within the plant and should avoid transferring brushes from, say, a dirty area into a clean area. Although it sounds obvious, so quite when you go around food facilities, it's very frequently that someone takes a brush from a dirty area into a clean area as they do the sanitation. So it's very important to minimize cross-contamination in that point. Next slide. So when the large debris have been removed, do a pre-rinse, and obviously what this rinse does is actually release the visual soil or organic matter. Again, it's very important to use low pressure, because aerosols literally redistribute contamination throughout the plant and causes more problems than it solves. Next slide. In terms of the types of detergent, obviously there's lots of different broad range of detergents available, and it's very important to use the detergent which is suitable for your purpose. For example, you can have general purpose detergents, which are for residues such as lipids and carbohydrates, which are fairly easy to remove. But for protein residues, like you would find in the meat industry, for example, alkaline sanitizers are much more preferred, because if you use an acid sanitizer on protein residues, you basically stick the protein to the surface and make it 10 times harder to remove. So you always use an alkaline sanitizer for protein residues. You can use chlorinated alkaline sanitizers for lightly soiled surfaces. So the benefit of this is that you can actually clean and sanitize the surface at the same time. But it must be emphasized, you only can do this with lightly soiled surfaces, not heavily soiled. Now, acid sanitizers are used really to remove scale or mineral deposits from heat exchangers, etc. And you can also apply enzymes like proteases and lipases in order to remove proteins and lipids from the surface of contact surfaces. Next slide. In terms of applying detergents, obviously you can have soak tanks, which basically you dismantle the equipment and you put them in a soak tank. Foaming is very popular because you get intimate contact with the detergent and the actual contact surfaces. Clean in place or parts washers are very useful because it's all automated, so it saves time and wear on the machinery. Or you can use the traditional method, which is basically pails and brushes, which is more traditional in many food industries. Next slide. So after removing all the organic matter, if you wish, it then comes to the sanitation step. Some people refer to step six as rinsing. It's debatable about rinsing. Obviously, the pros of rinsing is that you remove residues of sanitizer and also reduces the generation of mutants. As I was mentioning, if you have residues on the surface which are lower concentration than would inactivate your target microbe, then it's potentially possible that it could actually generate resistant mutants, which are going to be harder to eradicate in the future. The downside of rinsing is that you have no residual antimicrobial activity, and therefore more likely to get recontamination fairly quickly, which we'll come to later on. Next slide. So in terms of chemical sanitizers, the effectiveness of any sanitizer depends on a few factors. Obviously, exposure time is critical. The more microbes, the more contamination you have, the longer exposure you need. Because, like all microbes, they die in a logarithmic pattern. That means they decline with time, not instantly. And it's also important to emphasize that different types of organisms die at different rates, as we'll come to later. So the choice of sanitizer, if you like, is really dependent on what the hazards are within the processing plant. Temperature, obviously the hotter the temperature, the more effective the chemical sanitizer is. But this is only up to a point. A lot of sanitizers actually start degrading above a certain temperature, so you can't use it too excessively. Next slide. So in terms of the effectiveness of chemical sanitizers, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, concentration is fairly important. It's very important to use the right concentration. And it's also very important to emphasize not more sanitizers, normally better. If you lead to corrosion, pitting, that can actually increase your problems. It also should be noted that a lot of sanitizing action, or the efficacy of sanitizers, differs on things like pH. So, for example, chlorine is very pH sensitive. If it's not within a certain pH range, then its efficacy is decreased. And as I was mentioning, it's very important to remove most of the visual organic matter from the surface of or whatever you're trying to sanitize, because a lot of soil or organic matter actually neutralizes lots of sanitizers or a broad range of sanitizers, and therefore reduces the efficacy. Next slide. Now, water hardness, obviously, water hardness varies between regions, and the fact is that the hardness of water can actually affect the efficacy of sanitizing action. Quaternium ammonium salts is typical of this. If it's high calcium or magnesium, again, it neutralizes quaternium ammonium salts and therefore reduces its efficacy. But you can remedy this by adding chelating agents such as EDTA. And as we'll see later on, bacterial attachments can make it nearly impossible to sanitize a surface because they become established in biofilms. Again, we'll come to that later on. Next slide. So in terms of microbes, I'm pretty sure you're all aware of basic microbiology, but just in case you're not, there's various microbes that we can encounter in food processing environments. Viruses are obvious ones. Now, viruses can be split into two broad types. You can have envelope viruses, which are basically a lipid coating which protects the DNA, and you can have the protein encapsulated viruses, which are a lot tougher. So for example, an envelope virus is HIV, fairly easy because it's only got a lipid membrane, which is very loose, it can be easily inactivated. However, the protein encapsulated viruses are very tough, and almost as tough as endospores, which we'll see later. So depending on what sort of virus you're looking at, it can affect decontamination efficacy. Next slide. Protozoa are another important group. Protozoa, especially human parasites like Cyclospora, Cryptosporidium, they are parasites that only can replicate within the GI tract of humans or animals. In the outside environment, they exist as cysts or OIS. And these cysts are very resistant to decontamination, so they might actually survive chlorination. And once again they're ingested, they'll cause illness. Next slide. But the most resistant structures encountered are the bacterial endospores. Spores are formed by two main genera, that's Bacillus and Clostridia. And spores are essentially dormant structures. What they have is a protective spore coat, which forms an impermeable barrier to sanitizers. And also the DNA, which makes the new cell, actually is in like a glassy structure. Again, sanitizers can't penetrate this structure, so this is why spores are so resistant. They've got a lot of protective structures, but once conditions become favorable, such as in food systems, they'll germinate and can cause potential illness. You've probably heard of Clostridium botulinum. This produces one of the most lethal toxins known. And I think it's estimated that 12 nanograms is sufficient to kill somebody. So it's fairly lethal, so you have to be really cautious about spores. Next slide. When we talk about sanitation, though, our main concern is bacterial contamination. That's from things like Listeria, E. coli, Salmonella. And in broad terms, there's two types of bacteria. There's the gram-negative and gram-positive. So the gram-negative bacteria have what we call an outer cytoplasmic membrane, which forms a physical barrier to sanitizers. So what you often find is gram-negative bacteria, such as Salmonella and E. coli, are more tolerant to sanitizers than the gram-positive bacteria, which have no outer membrane. Gram-positives are Listeria, an example of that. However, under alkali conditions, the gram-positive are much more resistant. The reason for that is because alkali conditions actually strip out the outer membrane, making the gram-negative more susceptible to sanitizers and other processes. Next slide. So we mentioned twice before about pitting and crevices on surfaces and why we should avoid them. And the real reason for that is because bacterial cells can form biofilms. So if there's defects on the contact surfaces, next slide, you can get a mass of cells actually establishing a small community. So these are layers of cells just held together by a polysaccharide glue. Once they become incorporated into biofilms, there's two main important factors to note. One is that the biofilm forms a protective barrier because the sanitizer can't penetrate within the biofilm, so therefore is protected from the sanitizing action. It also increases its stress resistance, or its actual resistance to sanitizers. Anybody in the industry who knows about biofilms know that they're nearly impossible to actually eradicate. So once you've got a biofilm established on a surface, as the product flows over that surface, it's just going to get recontaminated continuously. And biofilms are a big problem, as we'll refer to at the end of the telecast. Next slide. Obviously, in the market, there's a lot of different sanitizers available, and in order to become approved, they have to pass a certain test. These tests about toxic effects, etc., are important, but they also have to demonstrate efficacy in terms of inactivation of model or chosen bacteria. So, for example, a general disinfectant, there's a test called Hughes dilution test, which we'll refer to later, is tested against the efficacy to inactivate gram-negative bacteria such as Salmonella or E. coli, and a gram-positive bacteria, Staphylococcus aureus. Staphylococcus aureus is a notorious biofilm former and is fairly tough, and therefore they use it to actually test the efficacy of sanitizers. To actually become registered as a hospital disinfectant, you have to demonstrate the efficacy of the sanitizer to inactivate Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Pseudomonas aeruginosa is a powerful biofilm form, if you like. It's a very potent biofilm form, which uses a lot of polysaccharide to glue cells together and onto surfaces. But it's also implicated in respiratory diseases such as muscular cirrhosis. Now, in terms of sporicidal effects, you have to demonstrate that the sanitizer is effective at inactivating Bacillus and Clostridia spores. So depending on your application, it's very important to note what hazards you might face and what the actual sanitizer has to do. So in terms of the actual test itself, it's fairly straightforward. It's a AOC approved test, so you have to follow the procedure correctly. And in order to be on the approved list, you have to demonstrate a 5-log reduction. So what you typically have is a suspension of your test bacteria. You treat them with your sanitizer that you recommend will be effective. After a 30-second contact time, you neutralize the sanitizer, you plate out the survivors, and if you achieve a greater than 5-log reduction in cell numbers, then you can be put onto the CFIA approved list. And in the slide, I've given you a link where you can actually look at all the sanitizers that are on that list. Next slide. In terms of ideal sanitizer, you want one that can destroy as many microbes as possible. I've put vegetative cells there, but obviously if you can inactivate parasites, viruses and spores, it's all the better. A very important fact is that the sanitizer should be fairly independent of environmental conditions. So I've talked about pH. Obviously relative humidity can affect some sanitizing action, the presence of organic matter. It must dissolve in water because people use water a lot, and it must be expensive and easy to use and readily available. And this is why chlorine is used so much, because it is inexpensive, it certainly is easy to use, and obviously it's readily available. Worker safety is a key issue, so if possible it shouldn't irritate the skin or cause any distress to the people who are actually using it. And also, to avoid taints in foods, it shouldn't have an offensive off odor. Because if you get sanitizer in product and it makes it, even at the smallest residues, makes it unacceptable, that's going to be a cost to the product. Next slide. So I've given here in this table just commonly used concentrations of selected sanitizers. As you can see, for plant water, obviously use low concentrations, because obviously that's going to be incorporated into the product and it's going to have direct contact with the product. For food contact surfaces, you can have higher concentrations. But obviously for non-food contact surfaces, you can use even higher concentrations. And so it's very important when you're applying sanitizer to understand its application, the possible negative effects of residues. Next slide. So the list of possible sanitizers is very extensive, and I've only put here examples of them. There's plenty more available if you look for them. But the most popular one is chlorine. It's been used a lot in the industry. Chlorine dioxide, some people use it. Ozone comes and goes. It's on a comeback at the moment. Ionophores, quaternary ammonium compounds, very extensively used in the meat industry for the reasons I gave earlier. And trisodium phosphate, and one of the more effective sanitizers are based on peroxyacetic acid. Next slide. So in terms of chlorine, chlorine can be bought in its sodium or calcium salts. Calcium is preferred because it's less pH sensitive than the sodium hypochlorite salt. Obviously, there's nothing cheaper than chlorine. It's got a well-established history within the food industry. It was developed, obviously, as a gas in the First World War, and production practices evolved, and it made it very cheap and affordable and widespread. So it's got a long history, which is important. The main antimicrobial action of chlorine is the formation of chlorous acid, which is most active form. And the chlorous acid is why it's so pH dependent. So, next slide. In terms of effectiveness, it's between pH 6 and pH 8 where the chlorous acid is most the predominant form. But if you add acid to hypochlorite, then you produce chlorine gas, which is very toxic, as one well knows. So you can never mix acid and chlorine together. But there are problems with chlorine. It's certainly sequestered by organic matter. So, for example, you might have noticed that a lot of people add chlorine when they're doing vegetable washing, the chances are that once the chlorine hits the leaf or whatever, it actually gets sequestered and reduced and basically removes its antimicrobial activity, and that's one of the big problems in the industry today. But more importantly, it actually does produce chlorogenic chloroamines or carcinogenic chloroamines by interacting with proteins. And it's true to say if you were trying to introduce chlorine today, it probably wouldn't get past the regulatory authorities, because these chloroamines that are produced have been identified as a potential carcinogen. And also, chlorine is unstable at high temperatures, so anything above 70 degrees C causes degradation. And another important aspect is that it's corrosive, so if you use very high concentrations of chlorine, then it's likely to lead to things like pitting, which again produces nucleation sites for biofilm formation. Next slide. So in terms of activity, obviously chlorine is a very effective. It's depending on the concentration used, you can inactivate cells, spores and fungi. It's important to note that it has fairly limited efficacy against viruses, especially obviously the protein encapsulated, not the non-envelope viruses. If you ever use chlorine, leaves that characteristic odour, which isn't always preferred. But in terms of mechanisms, it's still interesting to note, despite chlorine being used for since the early 1900s, no one's actually totally sure how it does inactivate microbes. But what people think, it affects multiple sites within the cell, and it's interesting to note that you never get an increased tolerance to chlorine. You cannot get this mutation effect where you get enhanced resistance to sanitizer, which probably makes it why it's been used so frequently. Next slide. Now, chlorine dioxide, although it's 10 times as expensive as hyperchlorite, it's a much more powerful oxidizing agent, over 2.5 times greater than chlorine itself. And the good benefits about using chlorine dioxide is its stability. It's relatively stable in the presence of organic matter, unlike chlorine. And importantly, it does not react with proteins to form those carcinogenic chloroamines as a side reaction, so that's a big positive. Next slide. But again, it's got limited effectiveness against viruses, that's encapsulated viruses. It is unstable to high temperatures, it can't be used with high temperature cleaning regimes. But just a bit of information, there was an anthrax letters incident a few years ago now, as you might recall, in Washington. And it actually used chlorine gas to decontaminate those post-office, so it's got strong sporicidal effects. Next slide. Now, ozone gas, that was actually developed at the same time as chlorine, but obviously chlorine was much cheaper, so that had the good history. Whereas ozone, like I said, has had its ups and downs. It's coming back into fashion, though. The thing with ozone is that it has to be generated on-site. You can't buy it in a bottle or anything like that, and you generate it by either putting it through a high voltage field or through strong UV lights. But it is the most powerful oxidizing agent known, so it's a very potent antimicrobial agent. However, it's very poorly soluble in water, so you really maximum is 6 parts per million in water, but you can increase this if you actually apply a lot of pressure, but it takes a bit of effort and infrastructure to do that. But the big benefit of it, unlike chlorine, it doesn't leave any residue, so you can use it for decontaminating water, etc. Next slide. So iodine compounds are basically iodine solutions, if you like, and although you can say they're less germicidal than chlorine, they're less sensitive to pH, so they're more robust if you wish. But under optimized conditions, in the Chambers test, which is just another name for the test I referred to earlier, low concentrations can be used to actually inactivate model microbes. But importantly, one of the big benefits about iodine is that it's very effective against viruses, and therefore you see it used in dairies where they need to control bacteriophages that can cause fermentation failure. So one of the big benefits of iodine compounds is their efficacy against viruses. Next slide. So in terms of advantages of iodine compounds, obviously it's less corrosive than chlorine, therefore less likely to cause pitting. It's certainly stable when concentrated. It's fairly insensitive to hard water, which is important obviously. It can prevent mineral deposits, so it's good for deep cleaning heat exchange, etc., where scale might deposit. People use it as a hand dipping agent, as in it's not irritating to the skin. And it also has a characteristic amber colour, which tells you how effective it is. When it starts losing its amber colour, it's actually losing its efficacy. So you can, it's an instant visual assessment. Next slide. So the disadvantages of iodine, though, is that it is more expensive than chlorine. Well, everything is more expensive than chlorine. Depending on the food system you're looking at, obviously iodine interacts with lipids, causing rapid oxidation, and therefore it can form off odors in foods. It can vaporize at high temperatures, so you've got to be careful about what temperature you're using. As you all know, iodine can stain and discolor equipment. And it's not as effective at low temperatures, so there is a certain range that it is effective. And it can form foam, so therefore cleaning place applications aren't really applicable when we're talking about iodine-based compounds. Next slide. Another group of sanitizers that are currently available are the trisodium or ionic sanitizers. So examples of these are trisodium phosphate, quaternium ammonium compounds, and organic acids. Next slide. Trisodium phosphate essentially is an alkali sanitizer. It's really based on its pH effect. And so how it works, it literally strips the membranes from the gram-negative cells and therefore causes an activation. Because gram-positive bacteria don't have an outer membrane, they tend to be more resistant. So again, it's all about using the right sanitizer for the right application if you think gram-negative pathogens are going to be more of a hazard. Next slide. Now, quaternium ammonium compounds are widely used in the industry, especially the meat industry, due to the alkali nature, because they can remove proteins as well simultaneously. The benefits of quaternium ammonium compounds are they're non-corrosive, unlike chlorine. They're fairly stable at high temperatures, so they can be used in combination with hot water. And they've got a fairly broad effectiveness against yeast, moles, and gram-positive bacteria. They are less effective against gram-negatives, but obviously they are susceptible. But again, viruses are fairly resistant. Now, the key point with quaternium ammonium compounds is that they can be readily inactivated by surfactants. So if you have residual detergent present, then they're going to neutralize it and therefore lose efficacy. But another benefit of them is they've got what we call residual activity. So these are non-rinse sanitizers. So even after sanitation, you've got a protective layer there, if you like, which prevents recontamination fairly up to a point. Next slide. So the actual main mode of action by which quaternium ammonium salts act is that they actually form pores within the cytoplasmic or inner membrane of the cell. As I was mentioning, gram-negative bacteria have a protective coating, so this gives them a bit of protection against quaternium ammonium salts, but it's certainly not invincible. So what happens is that the quaternium ammonium compound diffuses through the membrane, causes hole formation in the membrane, and causes a significant cell disruption. Next slide. Gram-positive bacteria are obviously sensitive, but the thing with quaternium ammonium salts, and this is what's really a problem for a lot of sanitizers, is the potential problem of generating resistant mutants. What this means is that if you use the same sanitizer repeatedly, you start selecting for a subpopulation which are more resistant to the sanitizer and hence will affect your sanitizer efficacy. Next slide. So the reason for this resistance is really based on what we call the quaternium ammonium salt pumps. And what these are is that bacteria like Listeria can mutate in order to get a more active transmembrane efflux pumps. So what happens here is that the QAS sanitizer goes into the cell, but it's just pumped back out again. And more worrying is that this resistance to quaternium ammonium salts can actually be linked to drug resistance as well. So drug resistance means it becomes resistant to a wide range of antibiotics. So these pumps not only function to pump out quaternium ammonium salts, but they can also pump out these antibiotics. And the big problem there is that if you have drug-resistant pathogens within the food itself and you consume it and you get sick and you go to hospital, then they won't have that many drugs to treat you with. So it is a significant issue and really underlines the need to have sanitizer rotation on a regular basis in order to overcome resistant or the development of endemic resistant strains. Next slide. Now, peroxyacetic acid compounds are very effective sanitizers. It's one of the better sanitizers out there. They've got low foam, so they can be used for cleaning place operations. Obviously, if you have a lot of foam generation, it can make decontaminating difficult. It's certainly less sensitive to temperature, and you can actually combine it with an acid rinse to do a one-step decontamination, descaling, and sanitation exercise. So, for example, in plate heat exchangers, you can simultaneously descale and sanitize, which saves time. They are non-corrosive up to a point. Obviously, any sort of acid is going to be corrosive. So depending on the concentration used, they are non-corrosive. Importantly, they're tolerant to organic matter, so they're not going to be rapidly sequestered. But importantly, the reason why I emphasize peroxyacetic acid compounds is that they're effective against biofilms. Because they're not so sensitive to organic matter, they can actually penetrate through biofilms in order to inactivate those cells within the biofilm itself. So it's an important plus for that. Next slide. As I was mentioning right at the top, it's very important to use the right sanitizer for the hazard you expect to occur within the product or food processing environment. And as we mentioned, there's a spectrum of resistances to biocides depending on the type of microbe or infectious agent that you expect. So, for example, prions, which are these infectious proteins associated with mad cow disease, are very tolerant. They're very indestructible almost, as in heating won't inactivate them, and certainly no sanitizer will. And then down from them are the bacterial endospores, as we referred to earlier. Bacterial endospores are very tough and very hard to actually inactivate. Then come the protozoa cysts, the Cyclospora, Cryptosporidium. And then it comes to Microbacterium and non-enveloped viruses. So Microbacterium, as you probably all know, is Microbacterium paratuberculosis, causes tuberculosis. And the reason why that's singled out is actually forms natural clumps within food systems, like milk, for example. So it naturally clumps together, and it's like a mobile biofilm, if you like, is that the sanitizer has to penetrate into this clump in order to inactivate the cells within the center. And that's why Microbacterium is specially singled out. Non-enveloped viruses, they're the protein-encapsulated viruses, again, fairly tough. Fungi are moderately resistant to biocides. Vegetative cells are fairly sensitive, and as was mentioning right at before, lipid-enveloped viruses are most easily destroyed by sanitizers. So it's very important to know which hazard you expect to occur in order to pick the right sanitizer. Next slide. So this isn't an extensive list, but the relative biocidal activity, if your main concern is endospores or microbacterium, then peroxyacetic acid, chlorine dioxide, glutaraldehydes, I think, has been banned, so you can't use that, and ethylene oxide, these are very potent antimicrobial agents, so therefore you need to use them if you think spores are going to be a problem, microbacterium. If you think non-enveloped viruses or fungi, things like phenolics, ionophores, as we talked about earlier, and hyperchlorites are effective. And if it's a case you expect, like in the meat industry, for example, where Salmonella, E. coli are the main concerns, quaternium rhenium compounds are organic acids. Not as potent, but they're sufficient to actually inactivate those pathogens. Next slide. So in terms of where to focus sanitation practices, obviously you need to understand where the sources of contamination are. And in broad terms, you can say the source of contamination are either coming in from with the raw material itself, they can be derived from the actual facility environment, or they can be transferred through the food handler. And it's very important to know which one of these is the main source of contamination of a certain food production chain. So to give you an example, in the next slide we talk about the fresh cut produce. Obviously the hazards there are derived from listeria, because listeria grows in soil, it's naturally associated with plant material. But also pathogens like Salmonella, 0157, E. coli, Hepatitis A, Cyclospora, Cryptosporidium, all these can be introduced to fresh cut produce through contaminated irrigation water. So you have to select a sanitizer, if you like, which can inactivate these as well. In terms of the meat chain, in the next slide, the main concern really is Salmonella, Campylobacter and E. coli 157. All these are enteric pathogens and therefore introduced within the GI tract of animals entering, say, a slaughterhouse, and therefore can become distributed within the slaughterhouse. Next slide. In terms of ready-to-eat operations, as I mentioned earlier, Listeria monocytogenes is the really number one key, because with ready-to-eat products, they tend to be cooked or decontaminated, so they get recontaminated after processing. And invariably, it's things like Listeria, which can become adapted within the processing environment, that produce the most hazard. And I think you can go to a lot of drains or coal stores, or even those difficult-to-clean areas within a processing facility, and recover Listeria. And as we say, it's a very virulent pathogen. Next slide. In terms of environmental versus raw material, obviously that's critical, because if you understand where the contamination is coming from, you can actually do something about it. Now, a traditional view has been post-process contamination has been due to Listeria because it's endemic within plants, and raw material essentially brings in things like Salmonella E. coli. So we'll talk about raw material. This is the examples within the meat industry. And that's fine in a traditional view, but really you can actually study this in more detail by using more sophisticated techniques which are based on molecular epidemiology. Next slide. Now, obviously I can't give a very deep overview of molecular epidemiology, since it is actually a subject in its own right, and it will probably take another teleclass to explain it. But the good thing about molecular epidemiology is that you can actually identify endemic strains within a processing plant, and those actually introduce on raw material. And you can do this by actually looking at a DNA fingerprint of the certain of isolates you actually obtain from different points within the plant. Next slide. So to explain it in its very basic terms, obviously we can use our fingerprints to actually identify ourselves and differentiate us from different people. So you can use them in forensic science to track somebody down. Obviously, bacteria and microbes haven't got fingers, so we can't use fingers. But what they have is they've got different DNA, a bit like ourselves. We have different DNA between ourselves. Next slide. So Dr. Alec Jeffries, back in the 70s, actually developed a DNA fingerprinting technique. He got a Nobel Prize for it. And basically what you can do here is you can differentiate closely related strains based on their DNA fingerprint. So very similar to us, our DNA is going to be different. We can differentiate different bacterial strains based on their DNA fingerprinting pattern as well. Next slide. So just to give you an example of a technique, one of many, is that you can use techniques such as restriction endonucleases, where you can extract the DNA from a cell. You've got special enzymes that can actually cut this DNA into special fragments. And then when you run that fragment on a gel, it produces a unique fingerprint to that strain. Next slide. And what we can do to actually compare these fingerprints is use what we call a dendrogram, which is a bit like a family tree in a lot of ways. If you're identical, as in you're the same strain as another strain, then you can have an identical DNA fingerprint. However, if you're removed, i.e. a few generations upstream, where you've parted ways but related, then you're going to have a slightly different fingerprint. And this is what illustrates in this sort of tree diagram. On the right, you can see the straight vertical lines. That means they're identical. Now, you can see also little branch points, and that means they're related but not identical. So it's a bit like family trees, if you like, offspring and parents. So what we would do in a typical sort of molecular epidemiology exercise is we get isolates from different points within a process over a day or 2 days, and we can compare and match up the fingerprint patterns to see where contamination has been distributed, where it's been introduced, etc. And we've actually done this in our molecular typing studies on pork and beef chains. I haven't got, as I would say, too much time to explain the full details, but I'll summarize the results. Essentially, what we found is that when we did our sort of sampling in pork or beef slaughterhouses, surfaces within the actual processing facility actually got contaminated within the first 30 minutes of processing. So obviously, although it's nice to have sanitation, having a nice clean surface at the start, these are very short-lived, so you get contamination coming through with the carcasses being deposited on the contact surfaces and literally distributed to all the other carcasses. But what molecular typing really illustrated to us is that it's the actual holding area and transporter. So the transporter is the truck used to transport animals to the slaughterhouse and obviously the hell before they enter the processing line. But what was happening is that through molecular typing could identify that contamination acquired during transportation, acquired within the holding area, could actually be distributed onto the line. And also we had some work where we actually looked at the sanitizer resistance of our genotypes or our strains we got, and by using a dendrogram you could actually fit them and predict their sanitizer resistance based on their fingerprint, as in it's inherited, which it needs more extensive work, but it just goes to show a bit more power to the molecular epidemiology technique. Next slide. So the key point we found with our studies is that obviously the holding area and transporter were the reservoirs of contamination. And the key point is if you had to look at a point within the chain that receives absolutely no sanitation, or very small amount of focus in terms of sanitation plans, it's holding areas and transporters. And the reason for that is they're difficult to sanitize. Animals are coming in all the time. You certainly can't start putting sanitizers on the floor as the animals are there because you stress them. And obviously they're very difficult to sanitize as well. There's nooks and crannies and very difficult, very inaccessible. And any effects are fairly short-lived. You can sanitize an area, but you're going to get some animals walking in soon after and therefore recontaminate the surfaces again. But what we found is when we actually suggested to a processor to increase sanitation within the holding area, although the actual levels of indicator or fecal indicator bacteria didn't decrease, what we did notice is that the populations were less endemic. That means we're more transient. So endemic populations have to be avoided because these endemic populations are the ones that build up resistance and will become established. But by having transient populations, they haven't got time to become established and therefore are quickly removed. So although the actual numbers aren't changed, the actual population structure in terms of endemic, how they persist in the environment, is significantly reduced. The next slide. We've also done some work in the fresh cut industry with DNA typing. Here we followed a bacteria called Aeromonas, and we basically looked at the different fingerprints of Aeromonas as it went through from the field through to the bagging station. And what we found was that field-acquired contamination was literally redistributed during the washing phase. So although people talk about washing about removing contamination, it was actually redistributing it. And also the bagging station as well. That was another site of cross-contamination. So this is just illustrating that by understanding where cross-contamination events occur, you can improve the sanitation protocols in order to address those issues. Next slide. Now the food handler, if you like, is a very important source of not of direct contamination, but certainly cross-contamination, because food handlers could be handling raw product at 1 minute, be distracted, and then go to handling cooked product, thereby causing cross-contamination of pathogens such as Salmonella and E. coli. Staphylococcus aureus naturally occurs on the skin. 40% of the population are actually carriers, and they'll carry this on the skin, on the throat, on the nose. And Staph aureus causes intoxication. If you've ever been to a buffet and felt ill about 2 or 3 hours later, you can be assured that you've consumed Staphylococcus enterotoxin, which isn't pleasant, obviously. But other pathogens that can be transferred to food via the handler, the enteric viruses, Norwalk virus, rotavirus, and hepatitis A. These viruses follow a fecal-oral route, so if the food handler doesn't wash their hands properly, then they can transfer this onto the food itself. And it might be alarming to know you only need 20 of these particles, if you like, in actually to cause illness, so very virulent. Next slide. Now, the thing with food handlers is that you have to supervise them fairly efficiently. There's been a lot of cases where you can highlight the lack of supervision being attributed to contamination of food products. So supervisors have a lot of responsibility in order to identify and monitor the food handlers. So obviously it's very important for the supervisor to identify unsanitary or unhealthy personnel or practices. Certainly they must look out for things like cuts, burns, which might harbour staph aureus, etc. And certainly you have to look out for ill workers. Although people don't like to take time off work, or most people don't, they must have an ethic where if they feel ill, they can't come into work, and the supervisor must be able to see the symptoms and certainly avoid it. I can name a few cases where the supervisor failed to spot an ill worker and an illness outbreak occurred subsequently. Next slide. So in terms of food handling, obviously hand washing is very important, and without proper hand washing or improper hand washing, you can get transfer of the pathogens that follow the fecal-oral route, which are fairly virulent, hepatitis A, salmonella, things of that nature. And so the typical scenario is that food handlers visit the bathroom, fail to wash their hands, and therefore contaminate not only the food product, but utensils, and even other workers. Next slide. So it can't be emphasized enough that hand washing standards must be addressed, or must be actually implemented, and it must have signs there to actually tell the workers adequate hand washing practices. So things like hot running or cold running water with a minimum temperature, obviously liquid soap preferred, because bars of soap tend to just carry contamination. Fingernail brushes are very important, and obviously disposable towels, again, to minimise cross-contamination. Next slide. So it's not imperative enough is that hand-washing signs should be visual in place above hand-washing stations at all times. Next slide. Now, there's a lot of talk about the adequacy of hand-washing sanitizers, like which is the most effective. Obviously, alcohol rubs have come to the fore as the most effective, and some studies like the one I've shown you would illustrate that 70% alcohol is the most effective. The 4% CHG is actually chlorhexidine gluconate, if you're interested, but what we find in our studies, which we do a lab class every year where we test out the different sanitizers, the reality is normal soap actually is as effective as any sort of alcohol rub or anything of that nature. But again, studies do vary. Next slide. Now, some food processors actually have implemented a UV-based system where basically there's a fluorescent dye introduced on the soap of the worker, and they wash their hands. And if they haven't washed their hands effectively, it'll show up under the UV light. Whether it's going to become widely implemented is questionable, but it just goes to show there's technology out there where you can actually monitor at least the effectiveness of hand washing by the workers. Next slide. In terms of the current status of hand washing within the industry, obviously it varies between different food facilities, so this isn't global if you wish, but a survey performed in the States actually found that only 52% of supervisors, these are the people who are supposed to be supervising food handlers, could actually describe the hand washing procedure. So it's a bit alarming to know that people are being supervised by someone who actually doesn't know when they're doing it right or wrong. But I guess more worryingly is that only 48% of the workers could actually demonstrate compliant hand washing. That's the compliant is what I referred to earlier. So which really implies that 50% or 52% don't actually wash their hands properly. So it can't be emphasized enough that hand washing should be performed to the correct standard and using the correct procedure in order to avoid cross-contamination. Next slide. Obviously, to avoid this problem, what some food manufacturers and even retailers or food service outlets do is recommend the use of gloves. These are disposable gloves. The obvious advantages of gloves is that they do minimize direct bare hand contact with the product, therefore reducing cross-contamination. But also, it's easier to enforce. It's very difficult to know if someone's washed their hands right, but you can certainly see if someone's got a pair of gloves on. But there are disadvantages to gloves, and that they discourage hand washing. So if you're handling something, you get soiled hands, you're more likely to wash them rather than have gloves where you're not going to get soiled hands and therefore not wash them. And one thing I find when I actually view fast food outlets is a failure to change gloves, because you can get some workers who will think, oh, we'll use the same pair of gloves for all day long, and obviously that increases the risk. So gloves is a debatable issue. So next slide. So obviously, as I was trying to reinforce, hand washing is important. It's very important to make workers aware when they should actually wash their hands, and it's fairly logical to us, but it's very important to just keep it re-emphasized. Next slide. So in terms of future prospects, obviously there's a lot of people out there who's got their visions of the future. I think in my sort of experience and the results I've got is, it's the key point is this short-lived benefits of sanitation, as in it's okay sanitizing a plant, but after 20 minutes it could get recontaminated again. So the antimicrobial contact surfaces, like silver zeolite, is an example. There's obviously other antimicrobial coatings that's been used, triclosan being one of them. But you can imagine that they would be more effective at reducing recontamination compared to standard surfaces. But an interesting part of the future is the potential of using biocontrol. There's many belief that we live in a too sterile world already, and by using biological control, you've got more selective action against the sort of pathogens, if you like, you're interested in. So an example of this is bacteriophage. Now, bacteriophage are viruses that infect bacteria. So, for example, you can have bacteriophages that infect salmonella. And we've actually got a current project at the moment where we're actually looking at applying bacteriophage to remove salmonella from holding environments within slaughterhouses. They're very selective, as in they'll only take away salmonella, leaving the population there. So you don't have to have it totally sterile. You can selectively inactivate the pathogens. Another interesting area is the competitive exclusion effect, which is in the next slide. There's work being done using a combination of Enterococcus and Lactococcus, where they actually put these into a drain, and what they found, these are the researchers in the University of Georgia, what they found, it actually inhibits the growth of Listeria. So obviously you can't keep a drain sterile, but by putting this combination of bacteria down, which are harmless to people at least, they can actually inhibit the growth of Listeria, thereby taking away a niche of the pathogen. Next slide. Now, through lots of studies, it's very important to emphasize that a lot of the contamination does indeed arrive on the raw material. So it's very important for on-farm sanitation to actually take place. But as you can see, this is a drinking trough for in a Castle feedlot farm. Certainly drinking troughs have been found as a key source of E. coli 157. But when you look at how to sanitize a drinking trough, it just really brings to the problem what problems we face. Although these are hard problems, they have to be addressed in some way. Next slide. So in summary, I hope I've demonstrated that sanitation is very important in terms of reducing foodborne illness outbreaks and obviously increasing shelf life of product. Now, the success of sanitation is really dependent on the SSOPs established, the SAPs and staff training. These must be in place and must be effective. And finally, in the future work, if you like, it's obvious that we avoided the difficult sanitation areas, but at one point we have to really address the issue of how can we sanitize these sort of reservoirs of contamination, holding areas in drinking troughs, etc. It's a major challenge, but I'm sure the industry will come across and address that in the future. And that concludes my telecast. I'll be happy to have any questions sent by email, which is the address on the front of the presentation, and I will hand you back to Paul now. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Warner. That was an outstanding teleclass and a lot of information. I dare say we could spend an hour on almost any one of these areas that you touched on, and what you gave us was very, very useful. Thanks very much indeed. In closing, I will acknowledge again the support of the Ontario chapter of the Canadian Sanitation Supply Association. Their sponsorship allowed us to bring this presentation to you, and on your behalf, I will thank them very much. Thanks to all of you who have joined this teleclass. A special thanks to Dr. Warner for the time and talent that he gave us in his presentation today. Until we meet again, folk, remember to wash your hands. Goodbye.